Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we have live in the studio, sitting right across from me, Mr. Wayne Coyne from The Flaming Lips.
All right.
Here to talk about many, many things. Welcome, Wayne.
All right. Here I am.
Here
now,
you are.
Suddenly, now it feels like a real show.
Yeah. Before we were just talking.
Just before, I thought, I don't know if this is going to work today. And then it's something happens, and now it feels...
It's the theme song, really. Yeah. And I have to say that, you know, that our listening audience cannot see your amazing sneakers, which are, I guess, what was sort of a pinkish purple kind of situation?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what is that? I know. There must be a word for that. I think there was. It's fuqua or something like that. Fuchsia. There
fuchsia.
You go. But... Someone got these for me, who wears these type of, isn't it? What?
They're Nikes, yeah.
I mean, they're very comfortable, I have to say.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a pad in there that's really great, and he got them for me, and I was a naysayer, and I thought, yeah, I don't know if that's my style, and then I put them on, and everywhere I went, I mean, you must see shoes all the time, and I walked in here, and you're like, those are great shoes, so yeah, I was wrong.
Yeah, they work for me, actually. They work for you, and they work for me looking at them.
So well, thank you.
This is, of course, all we're going to be talking about is these sneakers, so settle in.
Well, there you go. I mean, but they're worth it. I mean, they really are that great, yeah. And I don't see very many people wearing this kind anyway, so maybe that's why
The color and, they contrast nicely with the gray jeans. With a ripped out knee in the left knee. I think.
Yeah. So. I have all my pants after about 2 years of wearing them have the exact same tear spots.
Huh.
I know something could be learned about my lifestyle. It's like this knee, not this knee.
Interesting.
My keys always wear a hole. I have this little. Usually, I'm wearing my key ring, and it wears a hole by my pocket.
Huh.
And I've got this one by my butt back here. Every pair I wear is the exact same thing.
Yeah. And then I'm looking, but there's also some sort of like planetary system going on in your sort of crotch region there.
Yeah, that's. There is. Yeah, I've got these little puffy glued-on balls that would be right where my genitals would be underneath my pants. Yeah, and I'm the only one that has it. Yeah,
Yes, for sure. And there are at least two smiley faces on your sweater.
There is. Well, we've been on tour and been on the tour bus, and there's always a lot of things that get attached to you. Yeah.
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 It's a thing that happens. It's funny. I was going back through your discography, and one thing that occurred to me is if you took the very young Wayne Coyne, late 80s, early 90s Wayne Coyne, and played him your new album, Oxymelody, which is... it's always hard to put it, but minimalist, electronic-driven... utterly different, of course, than what you were doing early on. If you played that album for young Wayne, what do you think you would have thought of it?
Well, I mean, if you go too young, that sound would just be so bizarrely futuristic. I'm sure the young Wayne would have said, like, man, that's cool. What is that? I want to see how I can do that. And for stereo systems back, even in the mid 80s, that low end that we've achieved on this new album.
The kind of synth, for the people who haven't heard, it's a buzzing synth bass sound that you kind of attack us with,
And it's like the loudest, it probably is, if we were able to measure, it's probably one of the loudest bass frequencies that's out there in the world, just now. I probably would have said, wow, that bass is insane. How are you doing that? I probably would have had a lot of questions from my older self. Like, how are you doing this? Yeah.
Why'd you break my stereo? Yeah.
Well, early on we would try that because we would have records that would do that. They would start off like really quiet and then something very dynamic would come in and you go, oh man, because we'd always have our stereos blasted as far as they would go. Yeah. I think I would have liked it. I mean, I think there is, The Flaming Lips have always been you know, we're drawn to that song, that emotional song. Yeah. There's a side of us that rejects that, and then we get, you know, weird and noisy and whatever. But, you know, that the song and the emotional, you know, thing that happens. I think our younger selves would have especially loved that. You know, that thrill you get when a crescendo of a melody kind of, you know, foretells itself.
Totally.
I used to get, you know, chills, you know, listening to certain songs, knowing, oh, this thing is going to happen. I think I wore that chill response out from listening to songs so much. But I think, you know, when you're young, that build is you know, I mean, there's only music can do that, you know. So I think I probably would have said, bravo, yeah.
And would you have recognized it as the same Flaming Lips that were in the early 90s?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when we first started, if someone would have said, you know, you're going to still be doing this, you know, 35 years from now, I would have been, I said, no, no way. I mean, come on. That seems like, why would we want to? I think, you know, back then, we were very much, you know, introverted, you know, it's and the idea that you would have to, you know, making records and putting them out and all that is for us back then was such a, you know, an embarrassing kind of other world to us. We loved making them, but then the idea that you had to go out there and present them to the world and fight for them and do all this other stuff. I think that's why we made so many records. You know, as soon as we could, we would retreat back and make more of them. I think we would not have wanted to believe that we were still going to be doing this 35 years later. And that we would have, you know, that we are going to evolve. I think when you're making, the record that you're making feels absolutely like this is what you want to do and you'll do this forever and you love it and you're in love with it and all that. And then, you know, in time, something else comes up and you move on. But I don't think you want to think that when you're in the throes of making, you know, you don't want to think, oh, this is just another stepping stone, another planet that we're visiting and we're going to visit thousands of them. You know, you always think, no, this is the truth. This is us. You know, we've arrived, you know, and, but, yeah, so I probably would have said, you know, whatever this music is, dude, I like it, but yeah, this isn't us.
Right.
But when I look back, you know, when I go from being, you know, the way we are now and look back at the younger Flaming Lips, I always, always just absolutely love it. And I can't very much remember why it got the way it got. And I think that's the source of most of, you know, your anxiety and embarrassment about your newest stuff, you know, because you kind of know, oh, it was this way and then it went that way. And you always feel a little uncertain about its meaning to you. But after about 6 or 7 years, all that seems to drift away. And of course, we have records that are, you know, go back to the early 80s. And
yeah.
I really have very little, no emotional connection to how it got made. You know, very little, you know, of anything, unless I'm sitting around with people that were actually there and they can trigger a few other memories. And I listen to it and I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And sometimes I hear it. And I have to be convinced that it's actually us.
Right.
You know, it would have been a song that we would just have worked on that day in the studio. It wouldn't have been something that we wrote and considered or played a bunch after that. Some of our music, you know, we've spent a lot of time making it and we play it virtually every night. So it's always with us. But some of it is just music that we make up on the spot and you never think about it again.
Mm. I was going to ask Matt to maybe play Sunrise, Eyes of the Young, which is sort of the title track of Oxymelody.
In a sense, yeah.
Because part of Oxymelody means Eyes of the Young, and sort of in Polish is that the...
it actually does. I mean, okay. We're saying it as yeah, Oxymelody, but I did talk to a woman when we were in Copenhagen whose first language was Polish, and she said it's... The CZ is kind of a, you know, and of course, if you're Polish, that is a lot easier to say, you know. I don't think my mouth wants to move that way. And then the melody, the ML part of it is mwah, is like a, is like a W sound. So the whole thing is very awkward if we're actually going to, you know, say it as if a Polish person was. But I never, thought of it that way. I always thought of it as just a, it's just as a great sounding couple of nonsensical words. And though it means something, actually means something, I thought that's amazing. But the part of it that we really loved was that it just was this funny sounding nonsensical thing. I've kind of sort of explained it that it could be one of the characters from Star Wars. You know, he's like a lizard, but he drives a spaceship and speaks English and all that. Yeah.
Admiral Oxymelody. General Oxymelody. Totally. Yes. Yes. So do we have that? Yeah, let's hear that. The sun rises and says so gladness.
The
electronics that, and people have used the word ambient, people have used it, you know, but the electronics that sort of pervade this album, that was also a kind of a characteristic of your last album, used somewhat differently. So, but where do these sounds come from for you? Are there artists you're referencing, or where, or things in the world that bring you there, or what's drawn you to this particular sound right now?
Well, I mean, I think mostly it's probably convenience in the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the way that we're sitting in a studio now, I mean, this to some people would be considered a big studio,
right?
Now, everything you can do can just be on can be on your laptop or on a big hard drive, you know, somewhere over there, and every sound that you may want, you can have it, or you can download it in a couple of seconds and be working with it in all kinds of effects and, you know, plugins and all these things. So, you know, it probably begins with that. You know, you start doing stuff, and before you know it, you're not really working with instruments per se. You're working with other pieces of recorded stuff, and you can so you know, willy-nilly manipulate virtually any sound to be something different than what it is. And all that stuff, I think, is so much fun when you get away from it feeling like it this is music, and music is played by musical instruments or whatever. And when we were doing the Miley Cyrus project, the Miley Cyrus
Dead
and
Pets,
the Dead
yeah.
Pets thing, you know, I mean, part of us was wanting to perceive our music, or the way that we could make our music, in a sense like the way a lot of pop music is made. There's a track that kind of has been, you know, worked and worked and worked to its maximum likable, you know, ability. And then I don't know if this actually done like this, but it seems like it's shopped around for a great, you know, exciting, beautiful, crazy pop singer to,
sure,
or rapper or someone to be on top of it. And then you blend them together. And Stephen and I, and Dave Friedman as well, we would have talked about this idea of, you know, the singer, you know, would hear the track, and the track would excite them, and they would do something that, you know, is in reaction to hearing the track. And we would have said, like, well, I wish we could do that. I wish the Flaming Lips could make music, and then Stephen and I could react to it as if we're the pop duo that's been given this exciting thing. So I think we started to kind of work like that. You know, we would just start making a track. We still work from songs as well, but that sometimes is a very difficult thing, because it's hard not to have it set in your mind what you think it's about, and you have to kind of just quickly work through that and you know, be open to a lot of possibilities. But a lot of times we'll just be working on something that is just music and a track, and it has chord sequences and stuff. We don't know exactly where it's going to go, and it gets to a point where I kind of feel like, oh man, you know, I want to turn this into a song. I kind of know what it could be about. I know what it is saying or whatever. And that's a great new way to work on stuff, as opposed to, you know, very early on, we didn't even have a tape recorder before we would go into the studio.
Right.
You know, the first time we would hear ourselves recorded would be, you know, in the actual studio, and none of us back then knew how to read music or anything. It would just be, you know, whatever we thought we made up and tried our best to remember it and hope it went well. And mostly for us, it would go better than what we were trying to do, because it's just kind of happening.
Right. Well, one of the cool things I think about your early stuff is how you were trying to avoid the small indie sound of records. You were trying to make big professional records that were weird, but were big sounding, not little tiny tinny indie records.
Right. Well, not as a not because we didn't like those records. It was just once we got into the studio, you saw all these other things you could do. We never thought, and still don't think that we're. I mean, I think the way a lot of people perceive musicians are recorded is, you know, if you're a singer, well, stand there and sing. I'll put a microphone in front of you, and the rest will happen, and you leave and right. go do something more exciting. To whereas we've never been a group where it's like we just play and someone records us, and that's it. You know, it's always been a production. We always sort of do stuff, and that's probably just because what we're interested in, you know. And so even early on, I think we discovered the very first time we got to record didn't cost that much money, and it was just a little recording studio that was just at the south side of Oklahoma City there. And we went down there and recorded, and you know, we allowed the engineer that was working there to do what he thought sounded best, you know, and we would do all the other stuff, but he would get the sounds, and then we would kind of suggest or dictate, you know, what we thought was, you know, the things we wanted to overdub and how we would do it and whatever. And then we took it home, and some of it we liked and some of it we didn't. And I think our great leap into becoming what we were going to be is that we, instead of saying, well, it is what it is, you know, we went back in and we remixed a couple of those songs, which at the time everybody was like, what do you mean you're going back in there to remix? It's like, what is, it just was unheard of that you would remix your songs and do different things to them. And I just thought, well, why not? I mean, you know, it's like we didn't like the way it came out. We didn't have that much time. Now we have some more time. We're going to go back in there and change it. So I think that set in motion the way we felt like we could do our thing.
Right. A much more radical way of doing business, which became the Flaming Lips way of doing business. So we're here with Wayne Coyne, and we're having a far-reaching conversation about the Flaming Lips, and we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
I was going through, it's a print writer's habit, I was going through what you're wearing. I missed the fact that you have actual sort of jewels attached to your face.
Oh, yeah, little sticky jewels that I put on, yeah. I mean, we did a show just last night, and it goes into the night a bit, and then I just wake up and feel like, oh, okay, I look like me.
Yeah.
Hasn't been that much time since we were just, on stage doing all this stuff, so, yeah.
You.
Why doesn't everybody do it?
I know. It's actually a good point.
I'm always relieved when I see weirdos walking around doing their own thing. I always try to remember, hey, it's definitely a more interesting world if people just get to do what they like, you know, with their fingernails and their hair and things like that. Yeah,
for sure. You mentioned Miley. Would it be fair to say that your association with Miley Cyrus has been the single most controversial aspect of the Flaming Lips career?
At long last, yes, you know. I think most people that like the Flaming Lips don't care about the Kanye Kardashian world of that sort of intrigue. It's mostly about, recording and music and art and stuff like that. So, I think it's fascinating that people really do care about that stuff, you know, but... And I can totally understand that, you know. And previous to working with Miley, we'd worked with
Kesha.
Lots of, but no one of her you know, that's going to be that, you know, that that visible, that, you know, that that much that you're going to, everybody in the world knows her, probably more than we did, you know. But yeah, but and then to do so much stuff together, I think that's, you know, then that adds to it and all that. But I think in the end, well, not the end. I mean, I think before too long.
Yeah,
I think that won't really matter.
Yeah,
you know, I think the way that she's, I mean, she's already mature, but the way that she'll continue to mature and take chances and be really her own great spokesperson. Yeah, I think it's already kind of happened. I think in the way that she's made the record with us, and the way she put it out, and the way that, you know, it's all that is, and that's why we love her. I mean, I think anybody that it would be easy to think, oh, what is this stuff? But just listen to the records, you'll hear it.
Yeah,
all the other stuff can be, you know, it can be confusing, and it can be right or wrong or whatever you think. But if you listen to the stuff we've done together, it just blows me away.
It feels like it's as much as about Miley Cyrus not being the person that people think she is, more than you not being the person that people thought you were, if you know what I mean.
Well, there's a segment of the Flaming Lips audience that I think is going right along with that.
Yeah.
You know, then they absolutely would think, oh yeah, we love Miley for the same reasons you do, and you guys working together doesn't seem that much different from working with Tame Impala or Nick Cave or Kesha or any of these other people. You know, it's just like another cool person. But there's another segment of the Flaming Lips audience that I think you're right, would have had a, you know, a smaller contained version of what they liked about what we are about. And this would have been, and I think it probably has a little bit to do with probably how old they are. And I can totally understand if you're in your later 20s and part of your earlier 20s was filled up with this Miley Cyrus, Hannah Montana character. And that went against what you thought was, it was musical or entertaining or cool or whatever, you know, that's stuck with you. And you're, you know, and then for the Flaming Lips to be over there where it's like, they've always been cool, they've always had these, you know, this aesthetic that I like, and then to throw those together, I think in the beginning to some people that was probably like, that we can't deal with that. But there are definitely younger people and older people who don't have that much invested in the way they think we are, or even in knowing who Miley Cyrus is. And so they would just come at it like, oh, well, what is this? Let's listen to it and see. That part of it, I think, really works well. And then I think Miley has some fans who, you know, as long as she's doing it, they think it's great. It wouldn't matter if she's working with us or whoever she wants to work with. So, but there is, yeah, there's a still a, you know, segment of people that just do not think that this should happen.
It's chocolate and peanut butter, like, how dare you, you know?
Right, yeah. Right, yeah.
It's, I think over the last, since 2009, however many years it's been, 8 years, you've made several really great records.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Embryonic is probably, I love that
record.
Well,
thank you, yeah.
It's a freaking wild record. I think at the same time, somehow in this period, I think you've come in for a kind of new kind of personal attacks almost on you that weren't there before. I think there's this idea that, like, and it relates kind of the Miley thing. It's like, oh, and I don't see why anyone cares that you ended a long relationship and all that. But it all, in people's minds, it all comes together and they're like, oh, Wayne's having a midlife crisis. Have you heard
exactly this
idea?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, I mean, I would say, I mean, I've had a crisis my whole life. I mean, it's like, I'm like, you're exactly right, you know. And
it's a whole life crisis, but yeah.
But I mean, I think all that, anything that gets away from it just being music nerds, which is what you and I are,
sure,
you know, really, anything that gets it away from that, I think is interesting. And,
yeah.
And part of what I think has changed, I mean, with me, is that I, you know, talking earlier about the way we were introverted in the early 80s, I mean, part of the way I've dealt with it is I've sort of become an extrovert. One part of me is an extrovert, and just is like, yeah, I'll just do whatever. I'm just a, you know, whatever the class clown entertainer part of me has to do, you know, I'll do it. And I personally like stupid gossip and stuff like that. I mean, I like it too. So, yeah. You know, when you're part of it, it's kind of like, I don't really, I, you know, I, I don't take it. You know, it doesn't really affect me. I mean, I understand there's like people are allowed to say whatever they want to say. And I am still, you know, every day, you know, 20,000 people say they love me. They absolutely love me. Right. And about, you know, a couple thousand people say they hate you. And you just go, oh, well, that's, you know, it's just the nature of kind of popularity and being out there in the world and, you know, you being open to it.
On a human level, is there any truth to the idea? Because it's no shame if it is. Has it been an era of experimentation and then something like a midlife crisis where you wanted to change your life? Or is it, I mean, is there any, are people right to any extent?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, anybody that gets to be, 45 and something happens to them, especially if you're, in a long relationship or something. I would say, but I don't know if it's, I didn't get a different car, and I didn't really get a different haircut. But I did get a few tattoos with Miley Cyrus. So, I mean, there would definitely be, if you were analyzing it from outer space, you might see, well, part of it is and part of it isn't. But I think it's probably that I'm lucky that I kind of have, and that's not my own doing, but I kind of have this energy that's, I want to do stuff. And
you also have freedom because you don't have kids.
Well, that's the other part of it. I don't think a lot of the world would consider that, but yeah, I'm kind of living, you're right. This great, unrestricted, mature life. And no one has stopped me. That's the other part of it, too. I just say, well, why not? And I could see when you see pictures of Miley and my girlfriend, Katie, and myself together. I mean, we look absolutely outrageous and like we're, and I could see what people could think.
It prompted probably your first celebrity sex rumor of your entire career, which is impressive to get to that place.
Well, I mean, and it is all, it's in the realm of the absurd, which we love. I mean, the very first time that we were able to go to the Grammys, one of these little things clicks in your mind, we think it's stupid and it doesn't have anything to do with music and it's all a popularity contest. All that is with us. But the other part of it is that it's absurd and it can be fun and ridiculous and it doesn't really matter. And so I think little by little, we would be open to that part of the music industry or being a slightly popular weirdo group, that fun part of it can be there too. And so even when we went to the first Grammys or being part of Beverly Hills 90210, I mean, all those things, if you don't go in there and say, this is absurd, let's have fun with it, you wouldn't want to do it very long. It all is kind of embarrassing and it's all kind of, there's some of it is stupid and
sure. In the end, I mean, how different is it really than walking in the space bubble? I mean, it's all
exactly. Yeah. But I think all that is part of our personality and would our music would not be as interesting if that wasn't there. All that stuff that goes into humor and fantasy and ridiculousness. Otherwise, I think we would be a kind of boring old man group, doing our thing, no compromises. It's like, but for me, I feel very lucky that those things drifted away. And it's probably because we've done it for a long time. I think it's great to have, these ideals and to see if they work for you or not. But after about 5 or 6 years, especially artistically, all that stuff gets a little stale. And, you want something to happen that makes you go, oh, I'm going that way. Because we're such good friends with Sean Lennon, we're always reminded of the complete insane left turn that John Lennon's life took by accepting and falling in love with and believing in Yoko Ono. And I think the Beatles music for me was made better for it. Everything about it became like bizarre and more mysterious.
I think you, Lennon reminded me. I mean, you've gone as far as there was a shirtless selfie, I think, on Instagram. You look good, by the way.
Well, thank you. All right,
very fit. But then there was an incident with a an unarmed grenade at the airport.
Yeah.
I think people combine. I think if I'm trying to think of where things gotten people said, I think people were like, is Wayne okay at that point when those things, you
well
know,
right yeah, and, yeah. And I think we would play into it as well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it wouldn't be that big of a leap to see what we do, and you know, you could look at our, you know, our song titles and all that. You could drive by right. my house in Oklahoma City and I think part of that we play into that
totally.
You know, and that I, depending on, you know, where I'm at, I mean, I do look like a weird, eccentric old guy.
Well, you look like a rock star to me, but fine line.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
that's what they call rock stars now, weird, eccentric old guys.
And I think there's probably, I mean, there's a desire for those sorts of things out there. I mean, people oftentimes, you love to hear, oh, it's not going as well as they think it is. Look, or this is embarrassing to them or whatever. And I think we all kind of liked it, you know? I mean, we kind of... Especially in Oklahoma City, there was always a couple of guys that, you know, anytime something would happen, it would always be like, oh, good, this is our chance to get Wayne. He's a fake and all this, and this is going to prove it.
Wayne, yeah.
Yeah, and it would be so, we would get such glee out of their, you know. And the truth was, I mean, every time they would say something, they don't realize that, you know, this idea that people come to your rescue. You know, when everything is just going well, you never really know how many people out there will come and fight for you and die for you. And anytime anybody would say something about that, there would be so many people would come to my rescue. And they don't. I think that's the part of it they don't realize. You know, it's like you can say that, but it's going to be better if you say nothing. But I just think it's fun. I mean, we would love all that. Yeah. But you know, that thing of articulating is a weird thing, you know, because it has a kind of flow to it. And you and I were just saying, oh, it just goes so fast. And you know, your ideas and my ideas, they flow together. And that thing of saying and thinking at the same time is cool.
Yeah, it's funny. I've read about just what a intense tour bus companion you could be, probably maybe in the old days. That this just you were really into this relentless interrogation of your seatmate. Does that match your?
Well, I mean, you know, early on we would, you know, like all groups, you know, you're traveling around mostly, you know, America in a van with a couple of people, and you have long drives ahead, and you're drinking coffee and staying awake, and you know, and you have these long sessions, you know. I mean, we would do drives, still do, we'd do drives that are 20 hours long. Of course, nowadays you're on a tour bus and you would just watch a movie and go to sleep. There'd be no you know, you're not trapped with each other. But yeah, I mean, early on we would all be jacked up on, you know, on coffee and everything that we could do, and we were younger and testosterone and everything is on your side, you know. But I would say that I'm mostly curious, that I'm not attacking you.
You weren't being a dick, you were being curious. Yeah.
But depending on who you would talk to, but I would just say I'm curious about, you know, why are you doing what you do? Why right. you're saying this, but you're doing that? And I think we all learned a lot about each other in those times. Instead of just simply getting stoned and doing nothing, you know, we would listen to music. We'd talk about music a lot, talk about, you know, our lives, and we'd analyze each other best we could. And I think some people don't like being in the hot seat. You didn't see my fingers, the hot seat in quotations. But a lot of people do, and a lot of people don't know that they like it until no one else ever asks them anything about what they're interested in.
And, right.
You know, being interested in someone is how you show you love them. You know, asking them, why do you do what you do, is a way of caring about them.
I find your relationship to drugs, or often lack thereof, very interesting, because people, I think, who don't who might know your music but don't know much about you might assume that you've been pretty much relentlessly on acid since 1983.
Right, but that is far from the case.
Well,
it's just the opposite, really. I mean, especially with acid, you know. I mean, I've only done it a couple of times, and perhaps I could do it now that I'm older. But when I was younger, I couldn't really do any of that stuff. I would just get so scared, and so I think it. You know, losing control would be the, oh my God, that would send me into the panic. And of course, all those types of drugs make the panic worse, and the panic gets worse. And before you know it, you're just, you know, you're not having any fun. But I think as I've gotten older, I've probably been able to relax a little bit of that, or my chemicals aren't so intense anymore. And so I've definitely had more fun with drugs as I've gotten older than I did when I was younger, for sure. Yeah.
You had one, I think they've written about, like an infamous, horrendous acid trip, right?
Yeah. Well, it was, I mean, like a lot of people's acid trips, they just go on. Some of them just go on for a long, long time. And there's a part of the acid trip that you like, and there's a part of it where you start to get fatigued, and then it just keeps going, and your mind gets so tired and so frustrated, and so, you know, please leave me alone, you know. And back in the late 70s, when I did this, long time ago now, the acid was pretty potent, but we also, you know, there was a I forget what it was, a Jack in the Box. Is that still a fast food?
Yeah.
You know, it stayed open 24 hours, and you could go into the, you know, you could pull up there at 7 o'clock in the morning and get a milkshake and some French fries or whatever. And so, of course, we were all hungry, even though we're still on acid. And for everybody else that was involved in this was not horrendous. It was fun.
Sure.
For me, it was, you know, everything about it was becoming too much. And
what were you seeing, just briefly? I mean, what was,
well, we went up to order, you know, the yeah, line was long. Yeah. We must have stayed in this line for an hour. You know, it's like it was the only place in town that would be open that long. Went up there to order, and what had happened, and this is absurd to think about it today in the way that people deal with human blood and all this, but someone had tried to rob. Try to remember the way that the drive-ins are set up. There's a place where you get your, they take the money, and then a little bit up there is where you get your food. And so someone had tried to rob the first little section. You know, the guy had gone away to get the, you know, to tell the guy to put more French fries in, and punched his way through the window and thought he was going to grab the cash register. He's in his car, reaching in there, thinking he's going to grab the cash register and just grab that whole thing, and then they're just going to drive off. And he's punched a hole in the window, and he's reached in there, and it's just really cut his arms. Jesus. And you can see that this is blood that's from, you know, when you see that really thick, fast-moving, coagulated blood everywhere. So we're like four cars back, and this has happened. And I'm in this overwhelmed, fatigued, end of an acid trip state. And it's already like, oh my God, there's blood everywhere. He's literally wiping the blood up, you know, while he's taking our order. And my feeling was like, dude, you should just shut down the shop for a couple of minutes and get this together. But they're doing business as usual. And so there's blood everywhere. And then we get our food. And I look at the French fries as if, you know, like, and they're wiggling around like worms, and God, you know, I mean, I kind of get a little bit of a anxiety flashback.
Sorry.
Just thinking about it. Yeah, I mean, the sun was coming up back there, and I felt like I could hear the pink weird sun behind us, and you know, just gosh, you know, it all just comes back in that kind of with some anxiety and stuff. But yeah. But I don't think everybody else thought it was that bad. I think everybody else was like, this is insane. And then we're going to get to eat some cheeseburgers, you know?
Did your limited psychedelic experience, I assume, inform your music for decades to come? Did it factor in?
Well, I don't think we thought about it in that way. You know, I mean, we never really bought into the idea that, you know, music and drugs had that big of a creative connection anyway. I mean, I can totally understand where people, you know, that are just willing to do crazy stuff would take drugs and make music and do other things associated with not normal stuff. And certainly everybody else in my life, you know, my older brothers, my older sister, all their friends, I mean, they did drugs every day, all the time. Everything that everybody did was about drugs. And I think, you know, when we were younger, I was sitting in the corner drawing and painting, and while they would be out doing, you know, crazier things that probably I was probably slightly afraid of, but I wasn't that much different from them. And that would be the breaking point where it's like, you know, they would be doing drugs and I would be in the corner doing my thing. And I think that that world of chaos and drugs and all that, and yet I'm still able to do my little introverted thing, I think that is that's still what I'm doing now.
Right, that makes sense. You also said that you later realized you were getting a contact high a lot of times sitting there because after your recent you smoked some of Milo's weed and you recognized the feeling of panic.
It's true. You know, knowing more now of how what really potent pot does to my senses. Now I see back then all of my exaggerated worry, all of that. You know, I would always think, oh, something bad is about to happen, would be because we've been driving around all night smoking, you know, smoking pot. And even though I'm not smoking and I'm in the car with them and we're all
getting hot
doing
box,
stuff.
As to say,
And that came as a great relief because I do remember struggling with that and always going to like the worst thing that could happen. I mean, my brothers would have known friends of theirs that were in car accidents or motorcycle accidents and would have, you know, had their heads scraped off and it did the worst things possible. And I would always go like, oh, well, that could happen to us, you know? And so,
From that very unfun thing, I was going to say that listening back to your earliest stuff, and maybe Matt can find Unconsciously Screaming from Priest Driven Ambulance, because listening to some of your earliest stuff, and that's not even the earliest, that's already, you're already fairly developed at that point, but one of the things I thought, and I don't often have this reaction to listen to music, I was like, man, it must have been really fun to be in that band. You know, that sounds like a fun band to play in.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, especially if you're, I mean, the idea of being a rock star and making money and all that, it's like, well, that part of it wouldn't have played into it. But the idea of being able to, you know, you're writing your own music, you're sort of forging your own identity through your music, and you get to play with that. And then in that period, especially where we first ran into what's become our long-term producer, Dave Fridman, and him encouraging us to do stuff, you know, instead of us being embarrassed that, well, we don't do this thing where, you know, we record in the bathroom and the water's running. Could we do that? He would say, well, of course, let's do that. And, you know, he'd spend 3 or 4 hours setting up the microphones and all this stuff and encouraging it all. And I think that shows. I mean, I think it shows as things would happen, he would allow it to happen and he would push us further and help us. And it would be a happy thing that we're doing. And it doesn't take very much for people, especially, you know, sensitive, insecure people, you don't know if what you're wanting to do is any good or if it's stupid or whatever, but to have someone that's so authoritatively saying, yes, let's do it, this is going to be cool. And I agree. I think oftentimes about that period of the Flaming Lips, and it was, you know, about 4 or 5 months of just getting to do whatever, and nobody, I say it again, nobody stopped us. You know, nothing came in and said, hey, you know, I know you're having fun here, but you have to stop. And it just went and went. It's wonderful.
Do we have that? It's just freaking out on guitars and drums and vocals in the studio. That's fun, man.
Right, and you know, when we think about all the, you know, not millions, but there's, you know, there's so many effects, pedals and plugins and all these things you can do now. Back then there wasn't that many, you know, and you'd have to be slightly, you know, determined to put, you know, 3 or 4 of them together and make the, you know, all these unique and unlistenable, you know, things come out of your guitars and stuff. And yeah, I mean, I sort of felt like we were, you know, we were doing the thing that you could only do in that time. You know, previous to that, there wouldn't have been this, you know, all this stuff available. And you know, we some of it we're still coming at it from a very punk rock, non-musician sort of way of making music. And then in that period, running into Dave Friedman and Jonathan Donahue, who ended up being in the group Mercury Rev, suddenly this being influenced by these musicians, and them, instead of rejecting us, saying, "We want you to keep doing your weird, quirky thing, but we'll help you get through some of the music parts of it." And that was such a lift, you know, to finally have someone that could understand how you could get from one key to the next and it be something that we like as opposed to something that's awkward. And that was just beautiful. Yeah.
Right. You reminded me of the part of in the movie Get Shorty where he says, you know, you just put in the commas for in the screenplay and that will take care of it. Dave Friedman helped me put in the commas, sort of.
Well, no, it's very true. Yeah. You know, it's like you're doing this stuff and then you want there to be this other flow, the unknown come in there and say, oh, great. You know, I didn't know where this was going to go. And now it has some other color to it, has some other shade to it that you, I mean, music has to have collaboration. I mean, it's just I mean, I think the best music is this. Your mind on music can handle so much complexity and so much stuff, and it welcomes, you know, little surprises and all that. And I think our music has always been made so much better by something injecting into this thing that we're not doing very well, but then this other thing comes in and suddenly it becomes, wow, it's just uncanny how it got the way it got.
You got to fertilize the egg, you know. We have a couple minutes left with Wayne Corn. I just wanted to say, what's next? I mean, do you have a sense of where you're going on the next album? What the direction might be?
Not really. I mean, what usually happens is we're always doing stuff. I mean, whenever we're, you know, I have a studio at my house, and then, you know, so we're always doing stuff, and usually by doing stuff all the time, you'll stumble upon something that, you know, we'll all be like, well, what is that? What is this little thing? And Stephen is a great, you know, musical writer, and he's always writing stuff, and I'm always writing stuff. But it's that magic moment where we don't really know how it got the way it got. And Oxy Melody started like that. The track Oxy Melody, there's a track on the album called Oxy Melody as well. And it has this little magical mood that I remember after we did it, intrigued us immediately. And then we kept going back to it. A year later, we were still like, what is this? What can we do with this? And it made us try to do other music that was similar, like a piece of music that had this quality. And I don't know if we succeeded all the way, but certainly some of it carries a mood, you know.
And anything with Kesha again, is that ever going to...
I hope so. Yeah. You know, she's not as brave and as confident as like a Miley Cyrus. You'd think she would be, but she's, you know, she's very much able to be crazy, but she pulls back a lot. And I think the things that happened with her and Dr. Luke and all that, I think it's kind of made her a little less like, I'm not sure I want to go out there.
Freak out with the Flaming Lips right now.
Yeah. I always invite her though. I'm always, you know, every couple of weeks I'll give her a text and just say, hey, what are you doing? You know? And so, maybe in time. I mean, I absolutely love her, and she's. I mean, she, like Miley, I think is so great, and so talented, and so creative, and a lot of the story of what she is, you know, overrides. You know, just listen to some of the music, you'd hear it, yeah. And being around her for just a couple of minutes. I mean, the very first time I met her, we went to her house in Nashville, and she came out with her own tattoo gun, and said, first of all, let's get some tattoos. And I said, oh, okay. And her assistant quickly came over with a handwritten note that she wrote out as quick as they could. And I couldn't tell exactly what it said, but after a moment, it said, I won't sue Kesha if my tattoo gets infected, and sign it.
On that note, this has been...
It didn't get infected, luckily, yeah.
Good to know. I should have asked. But on that note, this has been an excellent, if I may say so, Rolling Stone Music Now with Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips. And thanks so much for being here, Wayne.
You were excellent. I love this scattershot. Yeah.
Me
yeah,
too, man.
The way my life is, yeah.
So please come back next week at 1 p.m. on Volume to listen to more Rolling Stone Music Now. And download us as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to subscribe, too. See you next week. Have a great week.